We've heard that Russians are talking about non-strategic nuclear weapons and Navy getting prepared. On the other side, we've seen that David Cameron in the United Kingdom was talking about getting involved in the war in Ukraine. Macron as well. We have a CDU member of Bundestag. He's talking about Romania and Poland, backed by NATO air defense, could start shooting down air targets over Western Ukraine. How do you see the risk of having a direct confrontation? Are we going to have some sort of nuclear weapons involved?
Well, the problem is that a lot of these ideas, for instance, this idea of shooting down airplane from Romania and Poland is not new. It was mentioned early in the war by some Western politicians. I don't remember which country said that. So this idea that came to the A German parliament is in fact an idea that was already in the air. But the problem with that is that if, and Russia made very clear that if its territory is touched by Western weapons, and probably even was if the Russian territory was targeted by British experts, soldiers, whatever you call them, or French, or fired from Poland, then the Russia would respond and will destroy these positions. But Russia is aware that if it's respond to destroy, let's say, a Patriot battery somewhere in Poland or in Romania, meaning attacking a military objective within the borders of NATO, it may trigger a nuclear response. And that's the reason why Russia announced its drill for nuclear weapons, because it's a signal, it's signaling to the West. We are ready to that for that possibility. That's the reason of the training of training these guys with nuclear weapons, because it's a way to make the response, the Russian response, credible, because they say, if you do that, and remember that after David Cameron said that British weapons could be used by the Ukrainians against targets within the Russian territory, that means civilian targets, by the way, because the war happens in Ukraine, meaning that the Russian military is in Ukraine. If you start to target, as the Ukrainians have done, for instance, in Belgorod, they target civilian targets. So that's important also to understand from a Russian standpoint. And that means that after David Cameron said that, and after you had this idea of Macron for deploying troops in Ukraine, the Russian Foreign Ministry summoned the two ambassadors, the British and the French one, to tell them that this would then, if it we come to that point, then Russia would respond. And the British, the Russians said that there would be no problem for them to respond on objectives that are not even in Ukraine or in the area of Ukraine. So they may respond anywhere in the world. But they know that by saying so, they may have or they may trigger a nuclear response, because after all, the French has more or less autonomous a nuclear strike force. The British is not so independent. It depends on the decision of the US, but anyway, there is a possibility of a nuclear response, meaning that the Russians had, at the same time they made this warning to the French and the British, they had to have this exercise on the or this nuclear drill in order to make their promise credible. So, meaning, we are telling you that, and we are preparing for anything you may respond towards this. So it's part of the strategic game, or the deterrence game, if you want, between Russia and France and UK. Now, I mentioned before that NATO has this document that was mentioned in the Corriere della Sera, which is an Italian paper, and there was this idea of this draft mentioning that NATO may not deploy troops in Ukraine. Now, we have to be very careful here, since we mentioned this. I think these things that Macron and UK and NATO. When NATO says NATO will not deploy troops or boots on the ground, it means that there will be no boots on the ground under NATO command. That's important too, because NATO has responsibility of troops under its command, if you want. But the troops that the French or Emmanuel Macron promised, in quotation mark, to Ukraine, these are not NATO troops. They are not under NATO command, because the France and other countries, by the way, have signed bilateral agreements with Ukraine for providing military assistance and military support, including probably deployment of military in Ukraine. So if, let's say, France deploys Foreign Legion or whatever, French troops in Ukraine, this may not be a NATO commitment. It's a French commitment based on a bilateral agreement. So when the NATO says there will be no NATO troops on the ground, that means it will be no NATO under the responsibility of NATO. And NATO can only take responsibility of what it's under its umbrella. But what France decide with its troops is outside of the umbrella. When France decides to deploy troops in the Sahel region, for instance, this has nothing to do with NATO. It's a French decision to use its forces for national reasons and so on. NATO has nothing to say in that. So if France decides that its interest is in helping Ukraine, it may still send troops to, even if NATO has said there will be no NATO troops in Ukraine. I think it's very important, because I when I see different commentators on the in the last couple of weeks saying, or in couple, the last couple of days, sorry, saying that, oh well, that the decision of NATO then is a slap on Macron and things like that. No, it's different. We're talking about different things. NATO troops is troops under NATO responsibility, under NATO command. And remember, for instance, when you had in Afghanistan, you had NATO troops in Afghanistan, but especially at the beginning, in the early stage of the Western involvement, you had in fact two forces in Afghanistan. You had the ISAF, which was under responsibility of NATO, and you had the I think it was Enduring Freedom, the US operations. So US is part of NATO, but the US troops deployed in Afghanistan were not under NATO. It's important to understand. So you may have you had US troops in ISAF under NATO command on the one side, and you had US forces under national command. And that even created problems because at one point they decide to have kind of a joint command, and the command could only be American. As a result, you had an American command depending, I mean, directly under the President of the United States, and NATO forces that were under US command. So the NATO was no longer under NATO, so to say. So this is the complexity of this question. What is under NATO is must be understood as under NATO responsibility, but you may have national deployments that go besides the NATO, and that's what we may have in Ukraine. So the fact that NATO may preclude an involvement in its next summit in July or so, is one thing, but it doesn't preclude that you may not have French Foreign Legion units deployed in Ukraine. I think it's very important to understand that. We're talking about different things here. So this means that I think the since NATO doesn't want to commit troops, it may indicate to France that it's probably not a good idea to deploy troops on its own. And that may have, if you want, a political impact on Macron's decision in a certain sense. But from a formal point of view, these are two different things. It are two different decisions. But one may affect the other on a political sense, if you want. And I think the fact that NATO precludes sending troops in Ukraine indicates that NATO has in its mind, it thinks that the cause is lost in Ukraine. And in fact, what we are witnessing now is a progressive the US is progressively abandoning Ukraine, in fact, because first of all, it's not good for the presidential election, especially for Biden. So it's better not mentioning too much that. And I think there was also an article in Politico mentioning that Biden should not mention Ukraine anymore because it will resonate as a failure. As a result, please don't mention that. But that may have other implications. And the US, what the US may have in mind now, especially when we see we look at what may happen in the next NATO summit, is that the US may in fact give the whole package back to Europe and say, well, that's a European affair. You were committed to that. Go ahead. That's your business. It's no longer ours because we don't want to assume a failure again. So that I think that's probably what we will see in the coming months. The peace conference in Switzerland. I mean, I don't have a crystal ball, but the odds are not good for this conference. Intuitively, I would think that trying to make a peace conference without one of the parties of the conflict is already a lost cause. So I don't really understand the Swiss. I really have a hard time to understand what's going in the mind of my fellow citizens in Switzerland because it's a total nonsense. But anyway, we'll see that this conference may not be a success. It will exactly basically what we will have in June. In mid-June in Switzerland is a repetition of what we had just before the World Economic Forum in January this year. It will be just the recognition of the so-called Zelensky plan, which is a plan that was elaborated by Zelensky last year, asking for a capitulation of Russia. So I'm not sure it's very well connected to the reality on the ground. But it pleases the West, so probably Western countries will praise this plan, but that's it. But I doubt it will have a concrete impact on the ground. As a result, the conference might be a failure, and we may have further failures on the ground. I mean, not just failures, but defeat on the ground in the coming weeks, meaning that there is no reason for the US to drag this conflict in the presidential election, and better to leave it to the successor of Biden, because I think nobody, I think, believes that Biden will be reelected on that. But again, I have no crystal ball, and happen what will happen. In any case, I think nobody believes that it could be a success, and even the most optimistic think that everything will end up in 2025. They just don't want to have ending before the election, because it will be the acknowledgement of a failure. While if it comes after the presidential election, that's something that will happen in the nobody will talk about, and Ukraine will just have its defeat in the shadow. And that's a little bit, I think, what is in the mind of our politicians. So that's not so positive prospect for Ukraine, and we should have we would have better off negotiating or accepting the terms that Zelensky proposed to Russia, and that Russia was ready to accept in March last year. And oh no, not last year, sorry, 2 years ago. And that would have provided better condition for Ukraine. But now this is tempi passati, as we say in Italian, and this is past. And now we have to look for the future, and the future is not so bright for Ukraine, I think, but we'll see.
This new administration of Putin, and it seems that he's doing a lot of modifications within the administration. Shoigu is out, and an economist is going to replace him. How do you see these changes in this new administration of Putin?
Well, I see that in a change in continuation, if you want, because in fact, Shoigu was it has been for about 12 years defense minister. And during those 12 years, he managed to bring the Russian military to a level which is unmatched, in fact. I can say unmatched because we can see with the with what happens right now in Ukraine, that the West is not able to match the capabilities of the Russians, both at the operational level and at industrial level. I think we have to remember that. As opposed to what we see in the West, in most countries in the West, the military industrial complex in Russia is still in large part state-owned. And that's the reason why, by the way, it's so easy for Russia to increase production and things like this, because then when you start to step up production, for instance, for artillery shells or missiles or whatever, you are not directly addressing the market conditions. That's the problem we have in the West, in Europe, in the United States to a certain extent. But after the end of the Cold War, the Western military industrial complex started to be privatized. As a result, now they produce according to the market law. I mean, it must be a demand, and the supply will match the demand. If there is no demand, there is no supply. This is the that you don't have exactly that in a state-owned type of industry, because then you the industry produces not based on the rule of the market, but based on the national interest, which may differ to some extent. That's why it's very difficult. For instance, in France, we see they wanted to ramp up the production of artillery shell. And even in Europe, because as you remember, the Prime Minister of Czechia had this initiative to produce or provide Ukraine with 1 million shells, and nobody was able to produce that. Why? Because although Western or European countries do have companies that produce artillery shells, the investment required to create new production lines and so on, this investment must be staged in a longer term view. You cannot just spend millions to increase your production just for a few weeks or months. It has to be scheduled and projected in the future. Well, on the Russian side, this is not the case. And that's the strength of the Russian military industrial complex, because it responds to the national interest. And that's, in fact, everything we have seen in the last 2 years in terms of increasing the capacities of the Russian military is in fact the result of Shoigu's work. And it's probably not a coincidence if now we have an economist that takes over for this kind, because the challenges ahead are in fact economical challenge or economic challenge. And that's probably the reason why Barulov, I think, or I don't remember his name now, was selected to succeed to Shoigu. But it's interesting to see that, as opposed to what we have seen in the West, that Shoigu was not very satisfactory and so on, and then was demoted and things like that. We don't see that at all. In fact, Shoigu will be the secretary of the National Security Council, which is probably the highest decision body in the Russian system. As a result, Shoigu was to some extent promoted in having this job, taking over from Mr. Patrushev, who used to be also in this position in the last couple of years. So I think what we have seen, and of course, Vladimir Putin was re-elected, so it's normal that you have a reshuffle in the higher position of the ministries. And in fact, you don't have so many changes, showing that in fact you have the current organization and current structure works at satisfaction, and there is no need to have radical changes. So it shows a stability, in fact, in the system. It shows that the system works. It shows that the system will be probably improved in the future, because there are certainly a lot of challenges ahead. And certainly the economic challenge is probably one of the biggest. I mean, Russian economy works well so far. It has, in fact, benefited from the sanctions, in the sense that the sanctions have pushed Russia to make changes that would not have been necessary otherwise, because Russia was relying on the international market for a lot of goods, including the Western market, of course, Western market. And by imposing sanctions, it made Russia more, let's say, conscious of the need of having their own production capacities and to expand relationships with reliable allies like China and probably India and probably others. And that's the because the natural, let's say, the Russians tend to look westwards, and that's normal because they belong to Europe. I mean, if you look at the continental setting, that's the way it is. I mean, this is Russia is a European nation and a European country, but it's also a Eurasian country. It's important to see that. And the sanctions have in fact pushed Russia to focus on the Eurasian dimension rather than the European. And that's something that is it's a very long debate in the Russian history. Even Dostoevsky in his books mentions this debate between the Russia looking westwards or eastwards. And at a time when China was developing, I mean, during the Cold War era and probably up to the early 2000s, China was developing and it was natural for Russia to look westwards. But today we see that China is, as I think Viktor Orban said, as Xi Jinping visited his country a couple of days ago. Viktor Orban said that today China is leading the world, and it's not leading in the same way the US used to lead the world, that's for sure, but it's leading anyway in terms of research and development, in terms of technological development, in terms of the, I would say, even in brain production to some extent, because if you look at the number of engineers that are coming out of the Chinese schools, it outmatches absolutely all the rest of the world, in fact. And even the Taiwanese go to engineer schools and and institutes in mainland China. So meaning that China de facto is, in fact, is leading the world, and it's the country that produces or registers the most patent every year. It's we see, and that's in fact the panic of the West reflects that change in the world order. That's probably no coincidence that Janet Yellen and Anthony Blinken and Olaf Scholz or Emmanuel Macron keep asking Xi Jinping to step down the industrial production in China and so on and so forth, because of course they cannot match with China. And even if they wanted Matt to compete with China, it would be totally impossible because the with a market of roughly 1.5 billion consumers, China can produce at much higher quantities, much higher quantities at much lower price, because they have a scaling effect that makes the price of production much lower. As a result, there is no point trying to compete with China, and the future of the coexistence, because China is there. I mean, we cannot make as if it wasn't there. It is there. And the problem of the West is trying to fight the problem, while the Russians have understood that you cannot compete with China, then worked with it. This is also, I think, a model of what the West should do. If you cannot compete with your adversary, try to work with him. That's the best way to have a win-win solution. And the US has not understood that, at least in the, well, I don't know, I don't like this expression, but the neocons, if you want, have not understood that. There is still a sense that the West must dominate the world. Remember the what Boris Johnson said just 1 month ago or so. He used to say, if Ukraine falls, then the West will lose its hegemony, and use the word hegemony, meaning that this is a strong sense in the Western leadership, even European leadership, that it should be an hegemony of the West. And that's exactly the kind of thing which, in my view, is totally misguided when we start to compete with China and later India. It's much better to work with them, to be good partners, in fact, and to develop things in partnership. And that's in fact that's interesting, because I remember in the early 2000s, end of the 90s, as you had, I mean, even before that, I mean, I should say that was even before, but in the late 90s, as people were trying to advertise globalization and so on, they said, well, that should be a win-win situation, because globalization should be, in fact, a partnership with others, and everybody can use its comparative advantage. And in order to make the world go higher and further, but it didn't turn that way. The West tried to use globalization as a tool for hegemony rather than a tool for partnership. And it's interesting. I mean, the orientation of Russia towards a Eurasian continent may in fact to some extent lead the way, because the Europe will have to do that. There is in the current, if you we look at the current situation, there is no prospect for Europe to compete with China. So we have to work with them. We have to work with the realities. The problem is that the Western leadership is work with narratives, and no with and not with the reality. And this is probably the qualitative change that the Ukraine war, but not only the Ukrainian war, by the way, because we see the same a similar evolution in the Middle East. And we see that the rapprochement we have seen between Saudi Arabia and Iran, for instance, indicates that there is also the same type of understanding. And we could also add the rapprochement, not rapprochement, but let's say the increased relation, economic relationship between the Middle East countries, including Saudi Arabia, with China, because everybody understands that China is the as we can see it from today, China is the future. And as a result, we need to understand that, and we need to cooperate rather than to antagonize China. So we have a parallel understanding in the global South, or the rest of the world, as you want to call it. But we see that there is this sense that the West used to lead the way in the post-war, post-Second World War times, certainly in the 60s, the 50s, 60s, 70s. But today, the West is no longer a model, both socially, economically, in a societal range, and in many aspect. As a result, and you have a challenger for that. You have an alternative, and that's Asia. And that's why we have this trend. So Russia has understood that, and now we have that in the Middle East. So it indicates, I think, the changes in the Russian establishment do not indicate major changes in the terms of a radical change or revolution, if you want. We have ra rather an evolutionary situation, but in the sense that this evolution that was guided or provoked by the sanctions go in the direction of the probably a new century, where Asia will be leading the way in the world. That's how I see it. I might be wrong, but I think for the foreseeable future, that's the way, and I think everybody understands that. So the and even I mean we I briefly mentioned the trip of Xi Jinping in Europe. We have seen that the purpose of the visit of Xi Jinping was in fact to visit Serbia and Hungary, and France was just there to just to keep the Europeans quiet, because if China would have been only to Serbia and Hungary, I think the Europeans would have considered that as a kind of provocation somehow, because these are the two mavericks in the European on the European continent, if you want. And so Xi Jinping paid a visit to France, but we have seen that this visit was not very fruitful, and in fact didn't bring any tangible result. While on the for Serbia and for Hungary, these were very tangible results. So we see that the Chinese were very subtle in their approach to keep the European quiet by visiting France, but this was just a sideshow, if you want, in order to have with the main partners people who are ready to work with China for the Belt and Road Initiative, and countries that have also understood that the European Union has some limits. And they have acknowledged these limits. I mean, Hungary is, of course, very vocal in the European Union, and we see that on each European summit. And my personal view is that the European leadership, I mean, the head of the European Commission, Frau, that's a German word for Madame Ursula von der Leyen. They should be more, I think they should pay more attention to what Viktor Orban says, because I think Hungary has understood that the European Union has provide probably some benefits. But it has also several and severe drawbacks that may affect the European economy in the future. And it's probably good to have a less antagonistic posture as regards Asia than Ursula von der Leyen. The problem is that the leadership in Europe is very, very supportive to US. Very close to the, I mean, even I would say institutionally close to NATO. As a result, you have this idea that there is still this hegemony, the sense of hegemony of the West remains very strong in the European leadership, especially in the European Union leadership. And I think that is not a guarantee for a good future, in my view. But so I think that is no coincidence that Xi Jinping visited Serbia, certainly because that was also the 25th anniversary of the bombing of the embassy there in Belgrade, but also Hungary. And we should probably look better. Pay more attention to these signals.